Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the just-released study by scientists at Stanford, MIT, and the Department of Energy, published in the journal Science, that finds methane leaks negate the benefits of natural gas as a fuel for vehicles. The lead author of this study, Adam Brandt, a professor in the Department of Energy Resources at Stanford University, joins us to discuss the downside of the current binge in the fracking, drilling, production, and distribution of natural gas, which is promoted as a clean energy alternative. But the study finds that the leakage of methane, which is a 30 times more potent greenhouse gas than CO2, offsets the benefits of burning natural gas instead of diesel. Then we will speak with Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel, who is a climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, about President Obama's announcement on Friday in drought-stricken Fresno, California, of a $1 billion climate resiliency program to help farmers deal with the effects of global warming. We will discuss the challenge of selling climate change to rural red state America, given the attitude of the Republican congressman who represents Fresno, whose response to the president's initiative is that global warming is nonsense. Then finally, Jeremy Scahill joins us in the studio to discuss his Academy Award-nominated feature documentary, Dirty Wars, and his new media venture, First Look Media, with Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, and the digital magazine they publish, The Intercept, where he has an article with Glenn Greenwald, the NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program. We'll examine the shadow world of JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command, and the role of U.S. secret warriors who now operate in between 70 and 120 countries at any one time. And joining us now is Adam Brandt, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Energy Resources at Stanford University, who works on reducing the environmental impacts of energy systems, more specifically understanding, measuring, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions from fossil energy sources, including reducing greenhouse gas emissions from transportation, energy supply, and from power systems. He is the lead author of a study published in the journal Science, which was conducted by scientists at Stanford, MIT, and the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. Welcome to Background Briefing, Adam Brandt.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And this study that you've come up with, specifically, it's the transportation grid, if you will, in terms of switching from diesel to natural gas that you looked at. Because, you know, we see buses going by all the time with signs saying that powered by clean natural gas. And fleets of trucks now are switching over. So give us a sense of what this finding is in terms of whether or not there are advantages to natural gas, or whether these advantages are offset by the leakage of methane.
Sure. I can talk about that. To back up a second, the genesis of the study was to try to understand and compile evidence from a whole range of studies that have come out recently about natural gas leakage. There's been a lot of controversy, a lot of studies, and a lot of variability between the results that make it really hard to judge what's happening. And so the goal of our study was to assemble a group of experts. We had about 15 people on the team to assess what we know and what we don't know about natural gas leakage. So we looked at over 200 scientific articles and tried to compile them on a consistent basis. One of the interesting things we found, or the key result that we found, is that it appears that the Environmental Protection Agency is underestimating methane leakage from natural gas systems. We think the EPA is underestimating methane leakage overall by about 50%. So you need to basically increase methane emissions by about 1.5 to match what we observe in the atmosphere. We don't know how much of this comes from natural gas, but there's a lot of evidence natural gas is a big contributor. When you run the numbers, what it looks like is that natural gas is still a good idea to use in the power sector. So if we're going to replace a coal-fired power plant, from a climate perspective, this is still a good idea. But if we're going to replace a diesel bus or a diesel truck, we think it's quite likely that the leakage rate from the gas system is sufficiently high that that doesn't make sense from a climate basis. We wanted to be really clear in the study, though, that it's only a climate story we're telling. There's lots of other reasons to like natural gas buses in our cities. They improve our air quality. They're much nicer to ride on. Human health impacts are much less, et cetera. So there's a variety of reasons to like natural gas buses. But from a climate perspective, we think they're not likely to be beneficial.
So when you add up, though, all of the nodes in the from the well to the bus or to the gas in your home or to the gas in the power plant, etc., there are all of these nodes where there could be leakage. I guess in every time at the bus depot they fill up the natural gas bottles, sure, there must be some leakage. I know in other countries like Australia, they've for the longest time you've had the alternative at every gas pump. You can also get along with gasoline, you can get CNG or liquid natural gas, they're like a nozzle pump that you have at the gas station. I know that every oil well also they flare off natural gas. So there's all kinds of leakage. Has anybody done a holistic study of the entire footprint of natural gas?
People have tried. The last major study was in the early 1990s, and that was commissioned by EPA, so it's about 20 years old now. Since then, there have been a variety of small studies, including a number of studies in the Los Angeles region, but none have been comprehensive. These studies tend to be quite expensive to undertake, and they're quite challenging. And so this is why there's so much uncertainty. We have a sense that the leakage rate is higher from the natural gas system than EPA is estimating. We don't actually know where this is coming from, what the exact cause is. There's a lot of speculation about leakage at natural gas wells, from pipelines, from processing plants, even from our homes and businesses. And there's evidence for all of these sources. We just don't know which one is contributing or if they're all contributing.
Well, my understanding is that the gas that comes into your home, they actually put an odor in because it's otherwise undetectable, at least by smell. Is that true?
Yeah, that's exactly right, yes. What you smell when you have a gas leak in your home is an artificial odorant that's added to the gas to make sure you know if your house is filling up with explosive gas. Otherwise, you won't be able to notice. And so this is added during the processing or distribution stages. And so leakage upstream of that, or leakage before they add this odorant, you're not going to smell this at a natural gas well. This doesn't come out of the ground. It's added.
So is there any correlation then between this boom that's going on now with natural gas drilling and fracking? Because one would think that if you are, you know, putting high pressure water and chemicals underground at tremendously high pressures that create these fissures, that they may not always necessarily crack open right at the wellhead. It's possible that fissures are created elsewhere. Is there any work going on in detecting the collateral damage, if you will, from the fracking boom?
There is, yeah, and there's a lot of work ongoing on that. There's a couple of things that we know right now. One, there was a recent study that was published that suggested if emissions controls technology or is applied at hydrofracturing sites, that the emissions can be quite low. That only has limited relevance right now because not all operators use these reduced emissions technologies. However, EPA is going to require them to use these starting in 2015. So in about 10 months from now, all operators across the country will have to use these technologies. Once those are in place, we think that hydrofracturing, at least from an air emissions perspective, is likely to not be a significant contributor to the problem. As of now, it's unclear how big of a contributor it is to the problem, but it doesn't appear to be major. This actually appears to be a problem with the much larger natural gas system, not just with fracking. So we've got almost 500,000 wells operating in the country. We actually have literally millions of miles of pipeline in the country. Especially under our cities, there's lots of small pipelines, lots of miles of small pipeline. And so it's a really complex system, and there's a lot of points for leakage. And so what it appears is that, you know, one part of the system, hydrofracturing, for example, is not likely to be the major contributor. The other concern with hydraulic fracturing is actually contamination of water. And this can occur through basically leakage around the well. So you'll get a fissure around the well that can result in gas escaping into an aquifer. There has been some evidence found of this, but the extent to which this happens is pretty unclear at this point.
And again, I'm speaking with Adam Brandt, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Energy Resources at Stanford University, and he is the lead author of a study published in the journal Science, which was conducted by scientists at Stanford, MIT, and the Department of Energy National Renewable Energy Laboratory on the extent of methane leakage, and particularly in the transportation grid, whether the benefits of burning cleaner natural gas as opposed to diesel are offset by the leakage of methane, which is 30 times more potent as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Now, my understanding is that methane molecules last a long time. They eventually break down into CO2, do they not? But they can last, for up to 800 years?
No, actually methane is a relatively short-lived molecule in the atmosphere. So methane is emitted to the atmosphere, and about half of it will be gone over a period of 10 to 12 years.
Mm-hmm.
But you're correct that when it breaks down, it actually breaks down to CO2. So it has a very large impact in the short term, and this short-term impact is much, much larger than CO2. But because it only lasts for a short time period, the impact over, let's say, 100 years, which is the most typical climate change assessment period, is not as large as the immediate impact. The immediate impact of methane is closer to 100 times that of CO2. But CO2 will last for 1,000 years in the atmosphere, whereas methane lasts for decades.
Well, just in closing, though, do we have a sense of whether this silent, odorless gas, which is so much more destructive in terms of greenhouse gas, how much it is contributing to climate change? I mean, it's just at this point a guess, is it?
We have some sense of how much it's contributing to the overall climate problem because we have a decent sense of what we observe in the air. So we know what's out there in the atmosphere, and we can fly airplanes and test this. Well, the hard part is actually knowing exactly where it's coming from, and that's what a lot of people are working on, is to try to pinpoint the source of this methane that we see in the atmosphere. There's good evidence that a large fraction of the leakage may come from a small fraction of the sources, and this is actually quite beneficial. That it appears that if we invent a technology to find these leaks very cheaply and quickly, that companies can go out and fix these large leaks, and large leaks can contribute a large fraction of the problem. So that's what we're working towards in the future, is to try to solve the problem by inventing ways to find these leaks at very low cost.
Well, Adam Brandt, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Adam Brandt, who's an assistant professor in the Department of Energy Resources at Stanford University, who works on reducing the environmental impact of energy systems, more specifically understanding, measuring, and reducing greenhouse gas emissions from fossil energy sources, including reducing greenhouse gas emissions from transportation, energy supply, and from power systems. He's the lead author of a study published in the journal Science, which was conducted by scientists at Stanford, MIT, and the Department of Energy's National Renewable Energy Laboratory. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how President Obama can sell climate change to red state rural America. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel, who is a climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where she is leading the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. Her specialty is isotope geochemistry, a tool she has used to study climate variability in places as disparate as the Arctic Ocean and the desert southwest. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Brenda Eckwurzel.
Thank you so much, and for talking about this important topic.
Well, the president was out here in drought-stricken California on Friday, meeting with Governor Brown and the Secretary of Agriculture and a number of farmers in Fresno, where he talked about the idea of setting up a climate resiliency program of $1 billion in funds to develop new infrastructure to prepare for climate disasters. And this has been met with tremendous skepticism. The Republican congressman who represents Fresno, Representative Devin Nunes, said global warming is nonsense. So how is the president going to convince red state Republican America that the climate events that they're undergoing, the droughts and floods and et cetera, are related to climate change and that they have to get on board the program?
The atmosphere is really nonpartisan where the carbon comes from. It's trapping heat when we release excess carbon into the atmosphere, and it's causing consequences for all of us on the planet. And those of us who are living in parts of the world that are getting excess precipitation and other parts of the world that are suffering a drought, how it expresses itself locally is very important to understand the links with climate change, especially when you're involved with farming. It's very important to understand, especially those crops that you have to invest in that take years to produce, like a mature vine in a vineyard or a tree nut, that you have to understand the location and think about 30 years down the road, what is the climate of the region that you're investing in those type of crops that are often very high-value crops.
Well, this proposal of the president's, this climate resiliency funds, follows the passage of the Farm Bill a week ago, in which the White House announced the creation of 7 regional climate hubs, which is supposed to help farmers and rural communities respond to the risks of climate change. Again, the programs are being proposed, but I don't know how you can get traction when you simply can't have a basic agreement about the fundamental facts, you know, of what's happening. When are we ever going to get past this ridiculous impasse between the climate facts and this, you know, this sort of recalcitrant denial that's going on?
It is very perplexing to not take into account the latest available science to make your daily life better if you're a farmer making decisions or a business person trying to decide what type of building you need to build that will take advantage of the energy infrastructure of the future and withstand the assault of extreme weather that may be coming your way, whether you're living near the coast or near in the inland river that may flood from torrential downpours, or if your soil is parched and you're suffering a drought and you're trying to make sure that you're able to survive some of these very extreme conditions. Because at the bottom line, a drought of this magnitude has grave economic consequences for the region and the country and the world. Australia is suffering major droughts, and they look as if there is some major changes because of the climate that are shifting the winds that normally bring relief in rains and storms that come across Australia. That looks like it's going to be a very parched landscape going forward, and that country has to figure out how to be resilient and deal with the changes that are coming ahead. At the same time, there are people that are building wine vineyards that are going other places that aren't traditional wine vineyards.
Well, we also have these ice storms here in the south and in the northeast, and then you've got the flooding in England. So is there any way for lay people, particularly the farmers who are susceptible to global warming denial, to be educated about connecting the dots here? I mean, at some point or other, I don't know whether you noticed the other day that Bill Nye, the science guy, debated this creationist.
Yes, I'm very aware of that.
I'm wondering why the scientific community are being so nice to these purveyors of ignorance.
It's interesting. I think that perhaps those centers that were announced, for example, the Ag Extension Centers, and having people within the community who can convey the latest science about climate change, probably are going to, as people face the risks of climate change, some of it from very wacky weather that is starting to change. And frankly, this is cutting-edge science trying to understand where the rainstorms are going to occur, when it's going to be a blizzard, when it's going to be flood conditions, and when it's going to be parched drought, because they change from year to year where, for example, in the northern hemisphere, where is it going to occur? You're going to need to understand these changes and be prepared for extremes that we really haven't experienced as a people who have really thrived as a civilization on what I would say is very predictable conditions. And we're not going into that world. And we're already in that point right now, but it's really going to get much more unpredictable. And so we need to have the latest science to give us a seasonal outlook, a year outlook, and figure out what to plant that year or what to do. And the more you deny it, the more you're going to be left behind. And that's something that we want to save everyone from. Even if they aren't aware of the information, let's listen to the experts and learn how to cope better in this new world.
Now, in terms of the people, the fossil fuel companies, of course, are, and preceding you, we were discussing the new study in the journal Science from Stanford, MIT, and the Department of Energy that's finding now that the seepage of methane from this boon in natural gas production, distribution, fracking, etc., is a wash. The benefits of natural gas are offset by the destructive climate gas, methane, the leakage of that. So having dealt with that before talking with you, Brenda, the question comes up, what do we do about the fossil fuel industry? I mean, they are powerful, they have a lot of money, and they don't seem to be on board with the science. I know companies like insurance companies are suffering. Maybe they could be an ally to counter, as a counterbalance. The other thing that's happening is that some cities in this country, Seattle, San Francisco, and Providence, Rhode Island, have divested holdings in fossil fuel companies. Is that a way to go for people in their retirement funds and their mutual funds to divest of fossil fuel companies? I mean, what can be done here? That's my question.
The future, we know enough about the science that the future extraction of fossil fuels has to reflect the externalities of the damages that occur. And it's going to take some very careful thought about how to send such a signal through the whole world economy on how to do that. And the transition, for example, some of the fossil fuels emit less heat-trapping gases than others, and so that has to be taken into account. And as you mentioned, for example, when it's natural gas is methane, and it's combusted for energy, it's released in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. If these leaks that you're talking about happen, molecule per molecule, even in the distribution systems where you have gasoline infrastructure in a city, the maps, the latest science of the maps of leaking of methane to get it to your home so you can turn on the stove and it's natural gas, those distribution lines are leaking immense amounts and they have to be fixed in our current infrastructure, because when that molecule releases into the atmosphere as methane, it will trap 25 times more heat than a carbon dioxide molecule. The trick is that methane molecule will swirl around trapping extra heat for 10 years, which we don't want, and then it turns into a carbon dioxide molecule with a little reaction that happens in the atmosphere, and it can last for many, many decades, and some of those molecules, maybe 20% of them, can still be trapping heat 800 years from now. So it's very clear we need to start winding down the extraction of fossil fuel and figure out economically how can we send a signal so that that transition is not disruptive to the economy, but at the same time, very strong signal that we start making the transitions away to better energy choices.
Well, Dr. Brenda Eckwinsel, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Brenda Eckwinsel, who is a climate scientist at the Union of Concerned Scientists, where she's leading the Union of Concerned Scientists' climate science education work aimed at strengthening support for strong federal climate legislation and sound U.S. climate policies. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back in the studio with Jeremy Scahill talking about his Academy Award-nominated documentary feature, Dirty Wars.
Infrastructure will collapse from vaulted spires.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now in the studio is Jeremy Scahill, an investigative reporter, war correspondent, and co-founder of The Intercept, a new digital magazine published by First Look Media. He is the author of the international best-selling books Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, which was recently made into the film Dirty Wars, now up for the Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary. He has an article with Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, the NSA secret role in the U.S. assassination program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeremy Scahill.
It's good to be with you.
And let's start with your new project. Is The Intercept a part of the new project that you're doing with Glenn Greenwald?
Yes. I mean, what Glenn and Laura Poitras, a great filmmaker, and myself had been discussing for some time creating our own news organization. It's not that we weren't happy working at places like The Guardian or The Nation magazine, but we wanted a place where we could have a more streamlined process to get news stories out and to work with primary documents from whistleblowers like Edward Snowden. So this is the first imprint of what is going to be a much larger media project.
And this is the one that the eBay billionaire in Hawaii.
If you had told me, you know, like 15 years ago when I first walked into KPFK that I would be working, you know, with the founder of eBay, I would have asked for some of the crack you're smoking. look, you know, it's interesting. All of us, and we know this here at Pacifica, are trying to find ways to fund and sustain investigative journalism. And Pierre Omidyar is the man we're talking about. Really shared a vision that Glenn and Laura and I had about building an adversarial media outlet. And so our interests collided and or merged together. And so, yeah, we're working on this project together. It's a strange affair. You know, I mean, I would have never imagined that I'd be working with Pierre Omidyar, but it's been great to work with him. And he's really encouraged us to build the kind of media outlet we want.
Well, your film, Dirty Wars, which is up for the Academy Award, to some extent, this is not its main focus, but you can't help seeing the dichotomy in the press between what Hazel Menken, I think it was, it said, you know, that the job of the press is to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. And it seems like that in many ways that the tables have reversed. And so much of when you appeared on the mainstream media, it was adversarial, mm-hmm. and that you're an outlier. So why not build from that point of view?
Well, I mean, you know what's interesting about that? I'm a very fast talker, and part of it is because I went to the Amy Goodman School of Journalism, but part of it is because when I'm invited onto those shows, if I end up on MSNBC or CNN or HBO on Bill Maher's show, I always assume it's the last time I'm going to be let on. So I try to get in as many points that I think represent a much broader swath of society that are often represented in the corporate media.
Well, I want to talk more about the film, obviously, because we're offering it up here in support of Background Briefing and KPFK in our fund drive. But just to touch on this, a surreal moment we have now, which, of course, is very close to the film in the sense that history is repeating itself. Now, apparently, the White House and the Justice Department are having some sort of soul-searching, perhaps, or at least conversations about whether or not to kill an American or how to build the legal justification to do so. And it leads you with this surreal conclusion that the advantage of being an American citizen is that they actually have a conversation before they kill you as opposed to just zapping you.
Well, you know, I mean, first of all, in our film, we tell the story of this American citizen named Anwar Awlaki, who was an imam in Washington, D.C., was a U.S. citizen who was born in New Mexico, and ended up becoming the target of President Obama's pursuit to kill him in a drone strike. And eventually he was killed in September of 2011. 2 weeks later, his 16-year-old son was killed. The kid had nothing to do with terrorism, hadn't seen his father in years. And it took the Obama administration a full year after those strikes to actually admit that it was, in fact, the U.S. that killed its own citizens. And Obama has admitted to drone striking four American citizens. But Ian, the story that you're referring to now came out recently in the press that they apparently are debating whether or not to kill another U.S. citizen. And my understanding is that the country in question is Pakistan, that there's an American there. To me, this indicates that they've already made the decision to do it. And they're sort of floating a bubble to try to see American reaction to it. But this administration under President Obama has assumed emperor-like powers over Americans and non-Americans alike. It's like the scene from Alice in Wonderland, where the queen says, you know, verdict first, trial later, and or sentence first, trial later. And, you know, we have the president who won the Nobel Peace Prize is effectively serving as prosecutor, judge, jury, and executioner. And I don't think American lives are worth a penny more than non-American lives. But what's important here is that if they're willing to go this far to kill their own citizens, it's a good indicator of how they view the rights of others around the world. But you're right. At least it seems as though if you're an American, there's at least a discussion in secret about whether or not to execute you.
A peculiar form of American exceptionalism.
Right. Well, but I mean, and other nations around the world are certainly in bed with the United States. But what's interesting is that Obama, because of who he is, has used his moral, political capital or credibility to try to say not only that the U.S. has a right to do this, but is right in doing it.
Again, Jeremy Scahill has joined me in the studio. He's an investigative reporter, war correspondent, and co-founder of The Intercept, a new digital magazine published by First Look Media. He's the author of the international best-selling books Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, and Dirty Wars, The World is a Battlefield, which was recently made into the film Dirty Wars, now up for an Academy Award for Best Feature Documentary. He has an article with Glenn Greenwald at The Intercept, the NSA's secret role in the U.S. assassination program. And you've got obviously an incredible source here, this U.S. Air Force drone operator, Brandon Bryant. And he is having, a dark night of the soul, isn't he?
Yeah. I mean, we have two new sources in this piece. Brandon, whose name we've used publicly, and he agreed to that. But then we have another source who worked for both the NSA and the Joint Special Operations Command, JSOC, this elite military unit. And both of these men were a part of scores of kills in Afghanistan, Yemen, Pakistan, elsewhere. And they came to a point where they felt that they were a part of operations that were indiscriminately killing civilians in pursuit of a relatively small number of potential terrorists or suspected militants is the term du jour. And that's part of the reason why they spoke to us for this story.
But one of the things that really got my attention in your film, Dirty Wars, was the special operations warrior who basically said, you know, that we have developed the world's most lethal and sophisticated hammer. And for the next several decades, we're going to be running around the world looking for nails. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of also the metaphor for the war on terror, too. And the film makes that really clear that in many ways we create our own nemesis. I mean, arguably George W. Bush was a gift that kept on giving as far as bin Laden was concerned. He did all of the things that bin Laden said that justified 9/11, you know, Christian armies on Islamic soils, grabbing our oil, destroying our culture, our cities, and murdering our people. And you actually have a clip in there of George Bush's use of the word crusade. I mean, that's the part of it that I find extraordinary. And the film The Dirty Wars indicates that on a smaller scale, that's what JSOC is doing as well. So how do you break this cycle?
Right. I mean, it really has become a self-fulfilling prophecy that the U.S. invades Iraq in 2003 after a merciless campaign of economic sanctions that stretched on for a couple of decades, regular bombings under the guise of the so-called no-fly zones. I know you covered that extensively at the time, as did I. But then you have Bush and Cheney decide to actually invade Iraq, a country where the only al-Qaeda presence was in the north of the country, where Saddam Hussein was not in control, in the Kurdish sections of northern Iraq. And that was the only AQ presence in the country. Now you actually have al-Qaeda-linked organizations seizing territory in Iraq, seizing territory in Yemen, seizing territory in Somalia. All of this can be traced back to the launch of this sort of borderless global war. And President Obama, I mean, to call it a war, though, is a bit inaccurate when you have the most powerful military in the world going up against people who have little capacity other than to blow themselves up or to occasionally try to take down an airliner. And the U.S., you know, is a major nuclear power with infinite military resources and corporations servicing its wars. But now under President Obama, you have a guy who comes into office and he has limited foreign policy experience, no military experience, and he's briefed by the generals, the admirals, the CIA, all of the intelligence agencies, and they paint a picture for him of a world where there are thousands of concurrent threats against the U.S. And that the so-called homeland will be struck if we don't take the fight to the terrorists. Obama's political advisors are listening in on those briefings, and they foresee a one-term presidency if there's an attack on U.S. soil. And so President Obama didn't just enlist JSOC and the CIA's paramilitary division to implement a policy. He made them the policy itself. And so you have this mentality that the U.S. can kill its way to victory. And I really think that we've hit a point, and I don't say this rhetorically. I say it because I've spent time on the ground in these places, where the U.S. is making more new enemies for itself than it is killing actual dangerous individuals who have the capacity to carry out a plot of any sort.
Well, is there any way to get out of this? I mean, we were wrong-footed from the beginning,
right,
with George W. Bush not only talking about crusades, but even using the word jihad, which is actually a noble term in a spiritual sense. Instead of referring to these people as criminals, it became instead of it being an intelligence and a police operation around the world. And after all, it did happen, 9/11, in the very city where the United Nations is. The world's sympathy was there for America. So we've gone from being the victim to the victimizer because of this footprint. And I take it what JSOC is about is, you know, a lighter footprint with a bigger hammer.
I mean, that's a good way of putting it. And, you know, you're asking about how do we break this cycle. You know, my answer may be something different than you would imagine, because it's not something about military policy or intelligence policy. We live in a country where corporations are entirely in control of our political system and our political process. There's a legalized form of corruption and bribery known as campaign financing, where almost every member of Congress, both houses, is bought and paid for by at least one corporate interest. And so unless we get corporations out of our political process, nothing will ever fundamentally change, because those who go to Washington are there on behalf of corporations, not on behalf of their constituents in most cases. So there's no incentive to actually say, well, maybe we shouldn't be doing these drone bombings. There's far more of an incentive to say, what's the next toy we can give the military to play with? And how does that make jobs in my district? And how does that make money and profit for the corporations that make it possible for me to keep winning these elections? So it's not about we need to just legislate differently, or we need to tweak this law or get these standards in place for when we kill an American or a non-American. Unless we address the root of the issue, which is that corporations have given an incentive to every member of Congress to continue to support these wars, nothing will fundamentally change.
But curiously enough, it's not your father's old military-industrial complex we have. We have a new adjunct to that, and that is this phenomenon of contractors, which came to light with the Snowden affair with Booz Allen Hamilton,
right,
which in turn is owned by the Carlyle Group, which is the ultimate in the insider revolving door. So to my mind, you know, what Washington has become, and of course you covered this in your book about U.S. mercenaries with Blackwater, but also Halliburton, is, you know, that we have a system. And curiously enough, Obama's signature healthcare was a victim to the same contracting scam where you can just hang up a shingle, hire the cheapest possible people, and then you mark up their salary tenfold to the taxpayer. It is – somebody described it to me as Washington has become Nigeria on the Potomac.
that's not – and having been to Nigeria and Washington, D.C., I actually don't think it's that far from reality. We have a radically outsourced bureaucracy in this country. The entire country is run by corporations. And when it comes to intelligence and military operations, what has happened since World War II is everything that Eisenhower warned against when he talked about the rise of a military-industrial complex. And he was only envisioning a world that had tanks and fighter bombers, not actually hiring of mercenaries to fight wars on behalf of rich nations around the world, even if their home country has no stake in them. So in a case like the Snowden story, what's fascinating about that is, you know, someone like Snowden takes the documents and says he wants to blow the whistle on the system and about constitutional abuses and waste, fraud, potentially crimes being committed by the CIA, the NSA, others. What if someone with his same clearances decides that they want to take sensitive information, intelligence, information about American citizens and sell it to another government or give it to the highest bidder from another corporation? We're sitting on a ticking time bomb with how radically privatized the national security bureaucracy is.
And I believe, Jeremy Scahill, that that is a subtext for the anger that the Germans have, that the NSA, because it's privatized so much of its activities to these for-profit corporations like Booz Allen Hamilton, their focus is not necessarily on national security but on economic espionage. And apparently, you know, Merkel's not that upset that we know what she has on her sandwiches,
right,
but she's really upset about the NSA finding out what Germany's trade position will be on these on this new trade compact that they're designing.
That's an excellent point. And, you know, there has been a rise in the number of and scope of the operations of private intelligence companies. You know, in some ways, the biggest scandal here is not necessarily the NSA spying on Americans or, you know, scooping up our data. In many ways, it is the corporations that are doing that with no regulation and no oversight whatsoever. And they could be working for foreign governments. They could be working for other corporations. They can be doing dirty tricks and surveillance on activists. And the FBI, the Drug Enforcement Agency, are systematic abusers of the privacy rights of Americans and non-Americans alike. And yet all we're focused on right now is the NSA. But there's a whole huge system that includes corporations and numerous federal so-called law enforcement agencies as well.
So let's return to your film, Jeremy Scahill. It's up for the Academy Awards, Dirty Wars. And JSOC, of course, came back into the news to some extent in a peculiar way when the biographer of General Petraeus sent a nasty note to a Lebanese-American woman down in near JSOC's headquarters.
Near Tampa,
Who apparently was wining and dining all of these generals, all of these top secret warriors. And we don't even know whether it was what the KGB used to call a honey trap, the idea that after these lavish Lebanese meals, there wasn't some pillow talk involved. And I've never, to the life of me, ever figured out what was at the bottom of that. Why did this girlfriend of Petraeus,
Paula Broadwell,
why did she send that note?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, have you ever gotten to the? I mean, I know this is like a tabloid version of what you've been covering, but it indicates to me a kind of arrogance and recklessness that's beyond belief.
Well, you know, part of the story that has not gotten much attention is that among the pieces of information that Paula Broadwell extracted from David Petraeus when they were in their relationship while she was, you know, writing his biography and serving as a sort of informal advisor to Petraeus is that in Benghazi, you know, inside of Libya, there was a covert operations program going on with the CIA and the Joint Special Operations Command. And that's never been fully investigated. And part of why it hasn't is because of the crazy carnival with the Tea Party and other groups focusing in on Benghazi as sort of the second coming of 9/11. There is a real scandal there that is not being investigated because it's just turned into a carnival of crazy. And the White House is the chief beneficiary of how insane some of these people are on the right, because there actually was a scandal there. I believe from sources I've talked to that the U.S. was running a hit campaign inside of Libya using the CIA paramilitary division and JSOC, and that this strike on the U.S. consulate that killed the ambassador, Stevens, was in retaliation to this program that John Brennan, who's now the CIA director, and other senior officials at the White House were running. And so the Petraeus scandal, as it was called, boiled down to the extramarital affair, which it always does. That's the only way you can lose your position in the United States. Is you can screw people all over the world, but if you literally screw someone other than your wife, then you're going to go down, right? I mean, you can screw whole countries over, but don't touch someone who's who you're not married to. And yet, I think there is a real scandal there that should be investigated. Remember, Petraeus was the CIA director at the time that this scandal broke. I would imagine, and I've heard this from people inside of that structure, Petraeus was at odds with someone powerful within the CIA and the U.S. military over something. Mm-hmm. And things like this don't just happen by accident.
Sure. I think it's pretty clear that the CIA didn't like him. I mean, if you read it, one of the most amazing pieces of information, which was buried in the style section of the Washington Post, was the tape that Woodward got hold of, mm-hmm. of Fox News, Roger Ailes, and Rupert Murdoch soliciting Petraeus to run for president through an intermediary. Breathtaking.
The way that they kneecapped Petraeus' career was incredible. There's a lot of smoke there, and it'll be fascinating one day to see what details come out. I mean, the right loved Petraeus, and Petraeus was one of the most powerful figures in modern American military history. And I do think that there were very powerful forces within the right that wanted him to run for president. And I think he probably would have had he not been taken out in this manner. Now he's lecturing at CUNY in New York and Yale and what have you. It's like,
well, when you hear this tape, you realize if you're Obama, and presumably Obama heard the tape, maybe even ordered it. But the long and the short of it is you had to keep this guy in the tent. So it looks like they dumped him on the CIA. The CIA weren't too happy about it, and they found a way.
Well, there's a war between the CIA and the U.S. military special operations forces that has raged in some form or another for 50-plus years. But it really intensified and came to a head when Rumsfeld was the defense secretary in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. You had the disaster at Tora Bora. Rumsfeld did not like the fact that the CIA could acquire members of the SEALs or Delta Force to put them on CIA missions. So he stopped cooperating with the CIA. And so what we've seen happen is that the U.S. Military forces under the auspices of the Special Operations Command have started to do more spying and get into the realm of the CIA. The CIA has gone back to its paramilitary roots and has radically escalated its involvement in overt paramilitary type operations. So you have these two entities struggling to maintain their domain but also become more like the other. And there's a real war between the two of them. So Petraeus coming in as a military man to the CIA at that moment in time was probably perceived by those in real power at the CIA as a threat.
Well, but curious enough, in terms of what we were talking about earlier, which is this supposed deliberations going on whether or not to zap this American in Pakistan, mm-hmm. is supposedly a result of these new guidelines that Obama approved last year, which was to move much of this activity away from the CIA to the DOD or to the JSOC. But it looks like with Brennan in there,
it's a smoke and mirrors.
Exactly.
I mean, people that I know within the intelligence community sort of laugh that anyone even gives any credence to this story. I mean, first of all, the military can do covert operations and has been doing them throughout its history. You know, under Title 50 of the U.S. Code, that is intelligence operations. Title 10 is military operations. The military doesn't need to work with the CIA to do a Title 50 operation. And that's a common misperception. And it gets repeated endlessly by supposedly well-informed journalists. This is a shell game meant to sort of trick or hoodwink the American people into believing that Obama has found a more effective, responsible way to assassinate people around the world. It doesn't matter if it's the CIA or the military doing it. Neither is an accountable institution.
But in terms of the budgets, there's no question that the DOD has almost unlimited resources.
Now, completely unlimited, yes.
They've been pouring money also, as we know, into intelligence as well. So in terms of oversight, who has the greater slush fund here and who is the least accountable? Because my understanding is that basically there's no accounting with JSOC. They just show up with bags full of money, buy people. If they don't buy them, they kill them,
Right. I mean, there's money laundering that goes on by both the CIA and certain elements of the U.S. military. I mean, there are slush funds around the world. In some cases, you have construction equipment that is sent over from the United States to Central Asian nations. And then the construction equipment is used for legitimate construction projects, but then it's sold to Chinese corporations and the Chinese pay in cash for it. And now you've developed a huge slush fund that can be used for operations in Uzbekistan and Pakistan and elsewhere. This happens all the time from both of those entities. Congress doesn't want to go anywhere near that. So what happens, it's not that there on paper there isn't a structure to oversee JSOC by the Congress or the CIA. It's that no one on Capitol Hill wants to ask questions to which the answer would make them have to do something or take a moral stand. So it's not that the heads of these entities don't appear before Congress, usually in closed session. It's that no one on Capitol Hill is going to ask them a question that's going to require them to take a moral stand against a military operation.
So, Jeremy Scahill, how do we then navigate between this constant killing by night that's going on with JSOC operating in, 50-plus countries or something?
Special Operations Command says now that there's over 100 countries where the U.S. has some form of an operation with Special Operations Forces.
And as you show in your film, Dirty Wars, where we'll work with warlords, you name it, like the Somali warlord that you profiled.
You know what you're going to see come out soon, and there's been trickles of it that have come out in the press. The extent of U.S. Involvement in Mexico and other Central American countries under the guise of the so-called war on drugs is far greater than we've been led to believe. And the U.S. is using so-called war on terror type tactics increasingly in Central and Latin America. And, of course, the war on drugs is a totally fraudulent entity. What it really is about is counterinsurgency. And you're going to see stories come out in the coming months. Some will be published by us that are going to reveal details about the extent to which special operations forces are operating in our own hemisphere under the guise of the war on drugs.
But the broader question I have, though, is that since the end of the Cold War, when national threats went away and subnational and transnational threats took over, and of course, we're obviously like, a giant supertanker. We're slowly turning much of our defense budget is oriented towards Cold War toys, etc. But this obviously the change has been this growth of special operations. And with all of this lethality, we still seem to have this problem where if you look at all of the wars that the U.S. has been involved with since the end of the Cold War, starting with Panama, which was the first one, what we've done is we have sent the military down to essentially get rid of one guy, whether it's Noriega, whether it's Saddam Hussein twice, whether it's Milosevic, you name it. So we beat the hell out of these countries. We sanction them, we starve them, and then we bomb them just to get one guy. Mm-hmm. So with all of this secret lethality, why is it that we have to go to these big wars as opposed to employ the JSOC people? I'm not suggesting
I understand
a policy of assassination, but I can't understand that paradox.
Right. Well, I don't think corporations wouldn't make as much money if
was
the policy.
You need the war.
War is the health of the state. I mean, it's the.
Right.
I really do think. I mean, it's not a conspiracy theory. I think it's just the way that the system is set up. When the NATO air war happened in Libya, when they were trying to, and then they successfully did overthrow Muammar Gaddafi. Gaddafi wasn't brought down by a popular revolution against him. There was a popular revolt against him in some parts of the country, but that's not what brought him down. What brought him down was the fact that the U.S. and its NATO allies bombed the living hell out of that country and completely incapacitated Gaddafi's ability to fight back against a foreign, incursion into the country. That was a huge profit moment for big war corporations. Each cruise missile costs $2.3 million, that's fired. And the U.S. just rains those missiles down. We spend an incredible amount of money developing these drones. Each Navy SEAL, we spend millions of dollars to train these individuals. If you just send them in for a surgical operation, the war corporations aren't going to make the money. They're not going to get to use their toys. So I do think a part of U.S. strategic thinking always relies on the idea that we have to use the most modern toys that we have, toys of war, in every operation. But it is an asymmetric war now. And people within the special operations community know this. The U.S. has started to adopt tactics that mirror al-Qaeda's tactics, you know, on the ground. Who's killing the Iranian scientists right now, the Iranian nuclear scientists? The video was just leaked the other day of this snatch operation that the U.S. did in Libya, where they took this guy who was suspected of being involved with the 98 embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. You know, the U.S. is involved to this day in kidnapping, in bumping people off, and in putting people in gulags in other nations, and all under the tenure of a Nobel Peace Prize winning Democratic president who is a constitutional lawyer by training.
And in your film, Dirty Wars, of course, the victims of some of these night raids, the ordinary Afghan citizens, in bewildered and in shock, having had their families and women and children murdered in front of them, talk about these bearded Americans, and they refer to them as the American Taliban.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, I mean, I look like the guys who killed their loved ones in many ways. You know, I'm a 6 foot tall white guy with a beard, and I show up in their village. I mean, they could have easily hacked me to death, but they didn't. They chose to tell their story. And you know, what was chilling for me in the journey of making this film and going to Yemen and Somalia and Afghanistan and elsewhere is that in different languages, in different countries around the world, we heard the same thing over and over again, that people said, when my loved one was killed or when the bomb hit our village, I wanted to put a suicide vest on and blow myself up among the Americans. It became so real to me and tangible how we are creating new enemies. We're not creating new terrorists. We're creating new enemies, people who actually have a legitimate score to settle against us. And 10, 20 years from now, I think we'll see the impact of what we've done now. It may not happen in the next year or 5 years, but we are going to pay a price for this.
Well, to my mind, that is what, in many ways, the message for your movie, the Dirty Wars, is that, you know, Bush tried to make the Iraq war as sanitary as possible. The press didn't show dead Americans or dead Iraqis. Mm-hmm. It was all a rah-rah cheer squad, largely, that led us into that quick victory followed by the slow defeat. And, you know, the fact that only our military and the military families bear the burden. I just spoke yesterday with a young woman who I had interviewed earlier during the Iraq war, whose husband was hit by an IED, fellow soldier, and about the painful marriage that they went through just because of this PTSD and the extraordinary trauma. And you realize that they bore the burden is largely on those that are sent off on these misadventures. But Dirty Wars tells you and shows you that this is all on us. Mm. This is where we're heading. You know that we no longer have the luxury of having this tool that is distant from us. You know, because it is as you point out, it's creating enemies. You know.
Right. And I mean, I think you're making – it's an excellent point too about military families in this country, because for the most part, they're the only ones that have to think about any of these issues on any given day. But if we don't start to sort of look at the humanity of the other in the course of now 12, 13 years of this so-called war on terror, we ignore it at our own peril. We're sort of whistling past the graveyard. You know, anyone who thinks that 9/11 was, you know, because people hated McDonald's and freedom, you know, didn't understand the history of that, of the organization of al-Qaeda, but also wasn't paying attention to U.S. and Israeli policy. We are making those same mistakes again. The forces we're backing right now inside of Syria, the forces that we've unleashed in Iraq through the invasion and occupation, the situation inside of Libya, what we're doing throughout the Horn of Africa, on the Arabian Peninsula. We are creating the very threat that we claim to be fighting with these policies. The greatest threat to our national security on a military level is our own national security policy. And that's pretty sobering to see in the flesh around the world.
Well, that was in fact the point I was trying to make, is that we own this. You know, it may be distant from us, and they may have tried to make it distant with these shadowy special warriors operating at night, but we're the ones that are going to endure the blowback. Well, Jeremy Scahill, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Keep up your great work.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer David Rochert. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.